Okay, Brian, we got aborted last week. I couldn't call you from the hotel, hotel/bunker. You didn't get to finish a week before or so because you got cut off. We were doing Bucky Fuller and McLuhan's annotations. Did we finish that, or was there some other things you discovered that you wanted to mention?
Well, I mean, I more wanted to bring it more directly applicable to you because the thing that Bucky Fuller had predicted, basically, was that the future, that the next shift in...
The two-way TV.
Yeah, and that the next shift in communication technology, that way the two-way TV would come about through narrowcasting rather than broadcasting.
Right.
So instead of everyone picking up the same thing, it'll be broadcast directly to you, and then his thought was you'll be able to say back to it. You'll be able to send it'll just be just as easy to send a signal back and say, no, I'd rather watch something else. So
right.
He imagined young people making their own little mini movies and uploading them to a central database and able to, you know.
Yeah, he still kept the centralist idea. But I was maybe one of the first. I defined quadrophenia in the mid 90s as broadcasting and narrowcasting and broadcatching and narrow catching. Those
right.
four phrases, you remember that, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And that's what that he uses the word narrowcasting or something? Bucky Fuller?
I don't believe he used the word narrowcast. Oh, now that way, well, I mean, I could grab my notes. I don't have them sitting right in front of me. No, I don't know. He didn't. I remember that. No,
but you're relating it to that, those terms.
Yeah.
What he was saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, now broadcasting is, how did I have it? Like, McLuhan was king of broadcasting because he took on the big patterns of non-one-way TV, the global theater with central scrutinizers sending out patterns of where it makes a market. Then, he was broadcatching. He would just look at patterns that were broadcast out. He'd catch them and make a pattern about them. LaRouche tried to do broadcasting because he was running for president. He was being active,
okay,
proactive.
Yeah.
So he had his magazines and newspapers and TV and radio shows going for years as he was trying to become the center of the big pattern. In other words, the White House, become the president. Then I said that William Irwin Thompson began narrow catching. He did the same thing as McLuhan, looking at big patterns, but with an astral body angle and references to angels and other things, from passively watching. So, but he was targeting a new age audience, not everybody like McLuhan was. So he was narrow catching, making similar kinds of patterns as McLuhan was, but not for everybody. Matter of fact, when he finally got a show about him on Bill Moyers in 1980, Bill Moyers Journal, he got 50,000 letters or more, and it was all crazy, nutty, and eccentric, and this and that, and he just said, I can't answer these letters, and he thought he had to. So he quit going for the mainstream, you know, going to be the new McLuhan. He satisfied just doing fringe activities, like at the Cathedral St. John the Divine.
Yeah.
And the limelight in the 70s. So he was broad, he was narrow catching. Now, Croker was narrow casting. Yes, Croker was narrow casting, but also open to broadcasting, broad catching and narrow catching. But he basically was laying out McLuhan patterns to the POMO world and a tiny branch
right.
of that. Because Severo Lutrangi told me when he first encountered Croker and his wife, Mary Louise, in the late 80s, they came to some conference. He said they were two people that seemed to him to come out of the woodwork, a phrase that McLuhan used, you know, termites or something. He really didn't get the Crokers, and he started the whole POMO scene with the Simutex series, but he found Croker to the point he said, who is he? Who are these two? What are they about? That's because Croker was satirizing the whole POMO scene from a McLuhan angle that Silvera didn't know, didn't understand. And so he told me that in the late 90s, Then 10 years later, he calls me up, Saverio Latrunje, and says, you know, I finally got around to reading Understanding Media. That's a damn good book.
Yeah. That kind of really shocked me when you told me that.
Yes.
I thought, like, okay, I gathered that they probably weren't familiar enough with McLuhan deeply to know that the whole scene was half only replaying him.
Right.
Just to think that someone in a position like, in such a theory position like that, could have not even gotten around to reading the one that everyone's read.
That's right. That prompted me to write that huge essay where I took all the guys that Saverio promoted, the French theory people, and then showed all their quotes, or best quotes were replays of what McLuhan had already said. And
yeah.
So now I'm going through that essay with Derek DeKirchhoff, and we had a summer break, but I emailed him to set up the next dialogue, and I felt that he was caught off guard by the Baudrillard quotes because he didn't know we were going to go into them. We went into them. You hear this in the last session, and they're too much to think about. So he didn't have any good responses right away. He had to think about it. So I told him, I'm sending you the next guy we're doing, Foucault, so you'll read some of these quotes and be prepared and have your comments to say. And here's what he wrote back. He says, about the second quote by Foucault. He says, I met Foucault way back and asked him after a reasonably interesting talk on autobiography in St. Augustine whether he had ever considered, whether Foucault had ever considered the role of writing itself in fostering not only autobiographies, but just auto in quotes. Derek says, Foucault could not respond. He indicated, in brackets, or pretended that he did not understand the question. So reading this quote, the second quote that I probably won't read it, but it seems that Foucault suffered quite genuinely from a monumental blind spot. Quite typical of the French cultural terrorist, I think, Derrida also, when confronted by myself over the same issue, simply looked dumbfounded and probably thought that I was slightly off my rocker. So he actually said McLuhan stuff to them. Then he says, about the penultimate on the unconscious, that'd be another quote in there, I find that very resonant with my own investigations on the, quote, digital unconscious. And his book on that is Point of Being, I think, the one where we quoted his colleague, the Christina from Spain, about the heart, her comments on left hemisphere and the heart and all this, and then she got outraged when she heard Ion sort of put her down. It's that book, Point of Being, that Derek's talking about, his investigations of the digital unconscious. That is, he says, everything that is known from distributed databases or can be known about you that you don't know. He is doing with his present colleague, who I met in Nice, they're doing the book on the digital unconscious. That's their title. But there's parts of it are referred to in this collection of papers called The Point of Being. So then he says, that being said, it is obvious that Foucault did very successfully a McLuhanist thing. You know, he's sort of commenting on me saying that there's McLuhan in Foucault. He says Foucault did a very successfully McLuhanist thing by analyzing the medium rather than just the content, but the aspect of the medium he addressed was not the technology but the style of the content, somewhere halfway between medium and message. Cheers, Derek. So that's a good statement, and that's true. That's what the formal thing remained in the level of aesthetics. And so they would look at the form of the content and never see the medium environment itself.
Absolutely, and it's stunning. Like when you're drenched in McLuhan, you can't even, you forget about the whole fish thing.
Right.
It's like you guys are so proficiently, like, with such, like, good laser, like, keeping on it. You're looking at this question of this sort of hidden consistency of the texture of, but you don't, it just doesn't take that final turn to just notice what they all have in common and where it arose and
The perceptual
communication technology,
they don't see the perceptual edge. They don't use the outer part of their eyeballs. I forget which one's the macula and the other part's the rim. But the thing is, they are in the end. You could categorize them by different older media. Most of them are POBs and from the art world. And they're part of that French snobbery about the Gutenberg arts. And so they constantly think McLuhan's talking about Gutenberg arts. They don't see the new environments as art. And Baudrillard later did catch up to McLuhan on that stuff, so he became the closest.
Yes.
I remember this famous French critic came one night to McLuhan's seminar, Monday night open seminar, and at the end of it, after hearing all these patterns that everybody was tossing around, but mainly McLuhan, he says, you know, it just makes everything so meaningless. Everything becomes meaningless. And McLuhan says, oh, no, no, I find meaning everywhere, every day, 24-7. He didn't say 24-7. That's 40 years ago. But the point is, the critic was stunned and looked at McLuhan, didn't know what McLuhan was talking about. These guys, you know, the French, they were a big part of bringing in the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and you could say the printing press moved to the level of education for people and the beginning of the newspaper world. So they are the visually... visual slash kinetic culture, and so they can't see the tactile, even though some of their poets did it.
Yeah, absolutely, and I mean that's the thing. Like you're saying, Baudrillard eventually was able to kind of make this breakthrough.
Yeah.
But even then, it's still okay. I'm thinking it's like a it comes back to this distinction.
No, it goes back to aesthetics. I saw him speak in New York. His big hero is Artaud, A-R-T-A-U-D. And he read something he wrote when he was like 18. And Severo gave me a transcript of it. And he's talking about the emptiness of the big fart or something that Artaud would say, or in his dadaist, surrealistic, ayahuasca-influenced mind. And you could tell that Baudrillard still was conceptually, aesthetically hooked into Artaud and missing what you're trying to say they missed.
Well, yeah, and... I mean, it's ultimately this POV thing of, you know, trying to get a good view of it and then articulate a good view. And it's like Baudrillard eventually made more of a breakthrough into a thing where it's more about the kind of haptic value of your writing rather than the visual view. And he starts writing about the more fatal virus theory stuff and that it's like a it's like a resonating with the environment in your form, and but he still is trying to articulate and describe that and get it in view as lucidly as possible.
Right.
Less of a dancer than McLuhan. I mean, I've always thought of it as in my explorings of culture and readings of the French guys over the years, it always seemed like what I liked the French guys for best was they were able to articulate certain ideas or describe certain things that I was interested in because, like, American or North American, at least, artists were enacting those things rather than describing them.
Yeah, yeah.
Like particularly Baudrillard often I find is very, there's a lot of, you can read a lot of Baudrillard as being descriptive of the Church of the Subgenius.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And
very much so.
And Baudrillard wrote a famous essay way back there about Andy Warhol being the last great artist, basically replaying the Android meme, in my terms. But
right.
Carolyn just finished reading Warhol's right-hand man, Bob Colicello's biography of Warhol. And he calls it Holy Terror because Warhol was a terrible person in many ways and ridiculous and exploited everybody in the worst way. So Bob Colicello eventually quit and then wrote this incredibly in-depth diary of his life with Warhol. But it's interesting thinking about the way Warhol was as a person and then Baudrillard romanticizing Warhol as the last machinic artist and thinking about the person, the empty person, the ridiculous, neurotic kid who never got over his fanship of the screen magazines he read as a sickly kid. And or if he did get over it, he kept insisting on doing it. So McLuhan defines pop art perfectly. He says, pop art is taking your environment, your media, stage, what media you're into, and making that your art, drawing attention to it. And McLuhan said that is still merging with the environment. It doesn't offer any real artistic detachment. So when you hear about Warhol's story, you know he wasn't capable of thinking it through what his art meant, what he was doing. And and when McLuhan met him, he insulted him, insulted Warhol, called him a yokel. I don't know if Warhol cared, but Ted Carpenter tells that story. So here's McClone being the greatest art critic, the greatest artist, all the levels, even better than Burroughs. And the Americans can't see that, but the French can half see it. But they haven't got the perceptual ability, having not grown up in North America, to see what McLuhan saw.
Yeah, exactly.
So you would like the French because they would describe the American art world or the American pop scene better than the American critics, is what you're saying.
And, but it was just, it's like, it would have, as much as I would enjoy it, as much as it was a pleasure, there was always this feeling of a kind of, I guess, Pyrrhic victory would be the phrase. And it's like, all right, you nailed it. And it's in the covers of a book in print. And the audience for this is so narrow. Meanwhile, Burning Man that you're describing is, like, changing thousands of lives every year. Like, anyway, I don't know, that kind of thing. Just, well, it's like, yeah, you nailed it, but
well, you know what?
At what cost?
Yeah,
the museum, you know?
In Laws of Media, McLuhan predicts that the tactile space extended through electricity will flip into a retrieved kinetic space, and that's the American values, the American bias, as content around the world. That's what won the Cold War, and that kinetic bias that McLuhan predicted would be retrieved in the 80s is what Baudrillard and Lyotard and these guys and Deleuze and Guattari are describing, the American kinetic post-book world. And they would go so far as point of film or something or pop music. So they were describing and seeing the kinetic replay but did not understand that it was a replay. And then, let's see, maybe Don Thiel would be the best to come up with that, but part of to actually take it further than the POMOs, but in the 80s, academia, the book culture, they prop up book culture, the academia of the United States, hypocritically, because really it's a post-book kinetic culture and becoming tactile. But the academics needed to hoik up French theory because it was the closest to what they couldn't describe because they didn't know the McLuhan. You know what
right.
I mean? So it propped up the educational academia in the 80s and 90s.
Well, that's the thing. It propped it up because it gave it a semblance of like, oh, no, we can't handle McLuhan because McLuhan won't let us get through a whole essay without reminding us, and you're obsolete. You're made obsolete by this.
Why are you reading this?
Yeah. The French guys give us a semblance of having it nailed it down into a view we can teach.
Right.
A method we can train of writing text.
Now, when Sever and I got together in the mid-90s in New York City, he was amazed at some of the stuff I was saying. I didn't know he was so uninformed on the McLuhan stuff, but my McLuhan derivative stuff was stunning him. So he invited me to a big 25-year reappraisal of the role of French theory from, what would that be, 1972 to 97. So he, as a French professor at Columbia, brought over these people like Barth and all that he knew in Paris because he was from Paris when he was a student in 1960 or so. So he wanted to get into the art world and make a scene. So he started the Semiotex newspaper and started to hoik up Foucault and all these people, brought him to a famous conference around 1975 at Columbia University or somewhere there. And he was telling me personally, and I would be the only one who would understand it, that the concert was disrupted by LaRouche. LaRouche and them were on to these guys and came in and caused huge havoc.
Oh, right, of course. I've heard about that.
Yeah, Tiberio has written about it. And but he started the French theory. So then 25 years later, in 97, he wants me to be a featured panelist and all that. But the old NYU professor, some stick in the mud, who was an authority on Foucault and that, Just at the description of my biography, he says, "No fucking way, we're having that guy at our concert, at our conference." So I got them to invite Don Thiel, and Don Thiel came and got to say his bit, which is really important. And then Sever put out a book of all the lectures and Thiel's lectures in there on the record, explaining McLuhan, anticipating all these guys. You want to say something, Carol?
Yeah, you're saying French theory. Do you mean C theory?
No, that's Canadian. That is Croker. And C theory stands for crash. See, Croker deals with the crash of everything, and so he called it crash theory, but he would call it C theory. No, French theory is the popularization of Foucault, Deleuze and Guattari, Virilio, Lyotard, Barthes was sort of a bit before, and who am I leaving out? Deleuze and Guattari, Virilio, Lyotard, Baudrillard, and Foucault, about five or six of them. That's French theory, and it was the 25th anniversary in 97. And that was probably about the time in the mid-90s when the neoconservatives were coming back in academia and suppressing French theory. It was on its way out. Derrida was the other guy, Derrida. And and they all commented on McLuhan in the late 60s, early 70s. They all, and why did they know about McLuhan? Because Ulysses had just been translated into French, and so all these budding Joycians were interested in what somebody in English would write about Joyce, so they found McLuhan writing about Joyce, so that's how they got into McLuhan, so through an aesthetic literary, you know, tunnel. But, so, because I wasn't allowed at the symposium at New York University, Silvere in December 97, or 96, 97, no, it was just before the media college, so 97, he had a replay of the conference in Banff's, Banff's Cultural Center. You know about that place, the Banff Center for the Arts?
And, yeah, I've heard of it.
So I was allowed to speak there. So there's Mark Derry's there and all these other guys who were maybe writers for Wired magazine and other female academics. Sandy Stone, I think that's her name, was there. A lot of them knew about the Church Sub Genius, and so they were quite shocked that there was a real Bob Dobbs who showed up.
Right, yeah.
Basically, I handed out my tiny note chart to everybody, and I didn't know what I could say, so I said, well, let's tell the truth. So I'm sitting there. Your present chairperson, head of the Ontario College of Art, Sarah Diamond.
Okay.
You might be in local. She became the head of the art colleagues, Eric. She was running the program in Banff. She worked in this program with Silvere. So she's sitting beside me. She introduces me. And so I started explaining that, well, back in 1972, when Silvere and I were hanging out with Baudrillard in Paris, so I started explaining my secret history and how I had triggered this whole French theory thing. I claimed I started it, and everybody was just dumbfounded because most of them didn't know who I was, and Silvere didn't speak
up. The ones who do know who you are already dumbfounded. They're like, wait a minute, you're saying you started that Church of the Sub-Genius, and now you're saying you started all this other stuff?
That's right. Yes, and Silvere never said a word. Silvere didn't argue. He didn't demur. So after a while, Sarah Diamond, who's sitting beside me, starts giggling uncontrollably. She can't. She's the hostess. She's trying to be sober, and she just collapses laughing. And so I looked over at her and sort of was just watching her laugh and sort of took that as a victory lap. And I might have said a few other things. Oh, one thing I did, the academic before me was speaking. He went over the 15-minute time limit, and I stopped him. I said, hey, buddy, I'm next. You can't go into my area. And he was outraged that I stopped him because these academics, they always go over. Nobody, they're all timid. They won't interrupt each other.
Yeah.
And this guy had never had anybody tell him to shut up. You'd get your 15 minutes. So that's how I entered on the scene with Sabine telling this guy to shut up. I'm going to speak now. So, and then I claim I'm everything. And, what else can I say about that? When I finished, nobody said a word, and I just went on to the next academic, next panelist. So it had no immediate, obvious effect. But I then spent the evening with the famous artist, Carolee Schneeman. She was one of the first feminist dancing performance artists. You guys know about her? S-H-N-E-E-M-A-N at the Judson Church in New York. She was guess what? She was the secretary of Zappa's hero. What's his name? Present-day composer.
Verez.
Yes, Verez, right down on the village.
Oh, wow.
And Carolee Schneeman, as a young art student, apprenticed with him, interned, and was a secretary. But she became this very famous early performance artist, running around like naked and rolling in paint and all kinds of things. So Carolee Schneeman, Silvere came to pick me up and at wherever I was. So I get in the car, and there's Carol sitting beside him. And I'd seen her perform. I knew her a bit slightly, but never had a chance to be with her. So I immediately started talking to her. So I ended up sitting beside her at the big dinner, and I kept quizzing her about how she made her films and that. And at one, she would describe, she had cancer. She would have a video of herself screwing her young whippersnapper boyfriend. So when I started to go in and ask her about, well, how do you hold the camera while working towards an orgasm and all this stuff, so I had these very intricate details about her body and her screwing right there at the dinner table, that eventually one of the leaders of the academic gang there told me to shut up. He said,
told you to shut up.
He did it politely.
Hey, this is dinner conversation buddy.
Yeah, I'm at the dinner. That's right, and she's always talking about being open like that and talking about these matters, showing footage of herself. But this guy said, he didn't yell at me, but the tone was yelling. He said, listen, Bob, you've dominated Carolee's attention for the last 45 minutes, and I think a few others of us would like to talk to Carolee. So I said, okay. So he objected to me hogging, but he really was pissed off at where it was going, where the conversation was going. But that is what happened to me when I was allowed into academia. And then
Well, that sounds like you made a pretty perfect impression all around.
Yeah, I was being what they were talking about.
You know, I mean, if they were wondering what to make of you after the academic presentations, then it's like, more data. This guy's only interested in talking to the performance artist woman.
That's right.
That's more slack.
Because they all were young worshippers of her. She was the queen, and I had gone to her, and a professor at Duke University interviewed her downtown in the village a year or two before, down in Soho, and they were doing a retrospective of all her film, and Carolee was sitting there pissed off because this academic had a job and could afford to have conferences and be okay, and Carolee says, tells the audience, I'm broke. You guys are celebrating me, but I haven't got a cent. And she was pissed off of what I had predicted to Michael Snow years ago, that the academia used the aesthetics, the artists of whatever was happening in the 60s, 70s, as the content for their academia, and they'd bring in these guys to speak, but they'd be starving themselves and struggling to get grants. And that is what they needed Baudrillard and Foucault and them to talk about aesthetics to be the intellectual framework for exploiting the artists.
Yeah.
It's William Thompson recently he said, education took over from art after World War II. That's a good point, that the Gutenberg arts were ended. McLuhan said pound of them should have stopped in 1922. But Donald Field said it was better to be a professor after World War II than to struggle in the streets trying to get grants as artists, because it was just too big and corporate. You'd be hard to make a living at it, and most of the artists had to be professors. Well, that was what Thompson mean. Education became the rearview mirror archetypal information pattern generator, and universities became cities, and that was the new audience for, quote, art.
Right. Yeah.
And let me see if there's something else. Yeah, you might have to say something, but there was – so I was leading there, so they So Carolee – so here I get in the car. There she is. I immediately pick up where I left off. I took her grievance she had expressed at the panel in this by the academic professor a year or two before. I said, okay, now you said this, what about that? And she said, and then she went on time. Well, yeah, I'm still pissed off. I mean, I'm not getting much for this trip. And I was thinking later when she got her cancer, that's why she had cancer. She was pissed off, bitter.
Right.
Just like Mae Brussels was bitter that she was, as a woman, not recognized in the conspiracy field. So I met them all, and eventually I meet them all. So then a few months later is the famous McLuhan Media Ecology Conference at Lincoln Center, and that's where I astounded everybody, and Mark Stallman came up and wanted to talk to me, and then we formed the Nonlinear Circle. And you'll see that the most recent article that I retrieved from LaRouche, 1988, he talks about the nonlinear physics, the nonlinear reality. That's his whole agenda. He's a dialectician who's recognizing the obsolescence of visual space dialectics. And there it is, nonlinear, and that's why Mark Stallman called it a nonlinear circle when he got together with me and Carolyn, because he was LaRouche's bodyguard. He was still doing LaRouche thing as his hidden agenda.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I read, I didn't finish that first article, the one by LaRouche, but I definitely read at least half of it.
Where's that?
It was kind of hitting the spot.
Yeah. Now, let's just check the, I don't check, they're arguing here. Various people, Blood Moon, are arguing about something. I haven't got time to look at it. We'll have to look at it later. We still want to do some books, and I also want to tell people, yes, new information will be released tonight, incredible information. You will hear it here. Just wait till we get through with Brian. So, Brian, what are some books that you've seen since Bucky, or is there more on Bucky you want to talk about?
Well, in terms of the McLuhan annotations, I have not been back to see other books. Although there was actually an interesting thing in a previous Bucky book I'd been looking at where, you know, that point Bucky talks about how there was a period right in the prime of his life where the increase in life expectancy was increasing faster than people were aging.
Yes.
And McLuhan's notes on that were interesting. He was noting that as if it was a shift from, as if that marked a shift from the center margin to center without margin.
Yeah.
That increasing life expectancy that weird dilation effect.
Are you saying are you taking a quote by Bucky or McLuhan?
A quote. Like McLuhan's notes on Fuller.
Bucky.
Fuller
so,
writing about the life expectancy thing and McLuhan noting.
Well, you know what I get from that?
Shorthand notes.
Yeah, that McLuhan saw death and taxes, the only constants, a product of centralized visual space. And when you go into the retrieved tactile space or post-tactile space of today, you get multi-consciousness and you don't have the centralized hypnotism of death.
Sorry, one second.
You wouldn't have the centralized hypnotism of death. is Kenzie saying something in the background?
No, sorry. I had to just go down the street, and someone else was saying something. I was listening, though.
Okay, get this. Am I right to say that McLuhan was pointing out the decentralist centers with everywhere, no margins, no center margin, you know, center and. Nobody's on the rim. It's all decentralized. That would be part of killing the iconography of death, which is a centralized experience for people to go through.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. There could definitely be something about that.
Yeah. Multi-consciousness.
I would have to look again at my notes, which I'm not in front of right now, to see if there was some because it was in Fuller's. The untitled epic poem one?
Yes.
So the notes were separated by a few lines, and it was while Fuller was talking about, and there was another note, but sorry, when you asked me, I wasn't in front of the notes, so
okay,
I don't remember exactly.
So the centralized multi-consciousness, McLuhan says, comes in with the electric and post-electric. Let's see. That's why, see, the intellectuals, the Marxists and leftists, the secular intellectuals, couldn't understand how McLuhan would be so perceptive and be a Catholic. But they didn't understand that you had the fragmentation of these memes and historical technical phases, and that one could deal with death or be religious or be a Catholic as part of your many selves. This is what they didn't understand about McLuhan. That was his quadriphenia. And he could still act out that stuff for a certain context. And he could also celebrate the ionic technologies that were coming. He would be Casey to talk about these things. In 1967 on the Christmas issue of McLean's magazine, Canada's National Magazine, and everybody's into this Christmas mood in that particular issue, he was saying, someday we will look up at the Star of Bethlehem in the sky, and it will have been man-made.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Huh.
See, that gets
into... That's a very interesting little thing.
Right, and it's in a little pop magazine, And it's anticipating Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where I think he has at the end or some point, I remember seeing a bit of it on a TV series, these elders were remaking planets that had been destroyed for various reasons. They were
right.
Making things.
Yeah, he goes to a planet-making factory.
Yeah, yeah.
The factory floor is this giant, super huge enclosed space.
Yes,
like
yes.
A warehouse for building planets.
That's right. And so maybe Douglas Adams happened to come across a McLuhan statement. He didn't have to, but if I met Doug, I'd point out McLuhan initiated by saying, no one's ever thought of the Christmas star as man-made. That's like too sacred. You wouldn't tell kids that one.
For sure, as a Catholic.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Because, I mean, just like right before you said that, you were talking about McLuhan kind of looking into other ionic technologies,
yes.
As you were talking about. Because he really did underline, at least the stuff that's collected in The Medium and the Light, his conversion to Catholicism and his attraction to Catholicism, he really did repeatedly underline this idea that it was safe, that it made anything safe.
Yeah,
it gave you a place to laugh at everything.
That's
know?
Right.
He keeps coming back to this point that nothing, you don't have anything to fear as a Catholic.
Yeah, you have detachment.
That's what I like about it.
Yes,
yeah.
He wrote about Catholics.
Not just detachment, but freedom to engage.
Right, now here's where he would disagree with the Pope. He'd say, okay, the Catholic by nature, by the nature of the dogma, that you have, you're in this world but not of it, so it should be a natural detachment. He says the Catholics should be enjoying the 20th century the most of all, but they aren't because they are visually biased. They don't know how to update, make their detachment tactile or whatever you would call it. And he
right.
was always upgrading the Catholic authorities that the Catholic was actually handicapped because they wouldn't look at modern technology for sinful
right.
reasons or whatever. And they were really getting suckered. And
right.
so that's what you just said, that he wrote many times. Now, Blood Moon says, the central scrutinizer says, death is an effect of visual space. Tragedy is an effect of the alphabet. Yes, I was telling her about that the other day. But the enemy of the stars, look at Wyndham Lewis's very influential play, which I think Blood Moon mentioned. So enemy of the stars. You would have to make a statement about the star Bethlehem in the Lewis vortices mode. If you were McLuhan, redoing that.
Right.
He had to say, you'll find that what he writes and says, he had to say as a vorticist, as a comprehensive
exactly.
vorticist.
Well, I mean, yeah, you imagine if anyone had ever commissioned Lewis to do a portrait of the Star of Bethlehem, I'm sure he would have made it look man-made.
Yeah. So, let's see, what else in your notes? But you don't have your notes with you right now.
Well, I was going to say that what you were saying about McLuhan reminds me of that never got around to saying anything about that group name for grape juice blog article.
Oh, yeah. You want to talk about that?
Getting into McLuhan thinking that it was encountering you or something you said from or your McLuhan essay brought them finally, okay, it's time to talk about McLuhan.
Right.
And, yeah, well, it was between reading and rereading that blog post. I read it twice, and it was good and everything. And then I was reading Neil Young's book, gave me the word to describe how could I in one word describe McLuhan's Catholicism in the sense of what made it different. He has a kind of a heretical almost idea,
yeah.
like it's a more mystic or ecstatic or something Catholicism. What's the word to describe it? And I was reading Neil Young's book, and Neil Young, he takes half a page or so to describe standing on a shore and watching the tide wash over pebbles and thinking about the way that they're changed incrementally and these things change over time. And it's just obvious he's, you know, painting this scene and he's using it using it as a metaphor or an analogy for life in general and how he thinks about things in general. And Neil Young, he said something, to me, this is paganism or Buddhism. I don't really know. And, you know, it's charming the way he doesn't give a shit about coming up with the correct word or something for
right.
what he thinks metaphysically, which is nice. But I immediately thought, oh, I guess the word for that, more than paganism or Buddhism, It's like, that sounds more animism. But no, it's more animism. A-N-A-mism, like an analogy animism. That
yeah.
It's not that everything is alive or every single thing is divine, but there's nothing that is cut off of a meaningful relationship with everything else. And so I think that maybe animism, spelled with an A, like an analogical animism,
yes.
could be
yeah.
a good descriptor for what they're trying to describe about McLuhan's Catholicism.
Right. I was distracted by this commentary. Where did this guy do this? Somebody on my Facebook page thought that McLuhan would make a useful comment about Trump. Okay, maybe this is it. Yeah, a few more replies. Yeah. So this guy, John Ono. Okay, could you summarize what you were just talking about?
Animism, that McLuhan's
yes.
Catholicism, you could call it a kind of an animism that, everything and every folly of culture still was intelligible and had the kind of
yes.
Coherence of divinity.
Yeah, yeah. They call that analog? You're saying that's analog?
I'm just saying what might be a good name for it would be animism. So instead of animism,
yeah.
like everything's alive, you say with an A, like an analogical.
Right.
Everything's alive with meaning. And
yes.
analogy.
Yeah, analog. And he talked about the analogical mirrors in his early writings.
Yeah.
And he
yeah.
said computers should not go digital, they should go analog, whatever that meant.
Mm.
And he said that in the late 70s. So here's this guy. He says, Bob, McLuhan's inability to explain things never prevented him from explaining them. You know that. He'd explain to, had I said earlier...
You had said McLuhan
oh, yeah.
can't really help us understand.
Yeah, that. I said McLuhan, as we know him, wouldn't have been able to explain the Trump era. So he's saying, well, McLuhan wouldn't have prevented him from explaining his stuff. And he says, you know that. He'd explain Trump, and he'd do it convincingly with that cute accent of his. And then he'd explain it the opposite way the next week, and it'd be just as convincing. So that's true that McLuhan could be charismatic by taking different points of view, being a quadriphenic. But what many belated people are not getting is why I say this. I go, not so much. McLuhan's language doesn't make it today. That's why there's no application of his perspective by those in the hot seat. And those in the hot seat would be anybody in the White House or in management crises at the level of TV, global theater patterning. So in the hot seat. McLuhan should talk about Henry Kissinger and them would be in the hot seat because they actually had to pretend they were responsible for whether it was nuclear war or not.
Right.
So I said that you couldn't use McLuhan's language as they used to be able to today for those in the hot seat. I said the knowledge structures of Bojar, Croker, and myself are found to be more applicable by those elites who manage the big patterns. That would be the broadcasters. That's why I have the final word on McLuhan. I wrap him up and put him away, and then I quote my quadriphenic essay. Then I say, of course, Iandam removes Bojard and Croker from the scene and leaves me standing pretty. But my point about McLuhan's language wouldn't make it. It's a very important point, which I don't expect anybody to understand. Maybe you get it, but you got to get into the five-bodied model and understand what that means. And Croker does use the multiple-body thing. For most people, they'll look at the Internet, POB people will look at the Internet and say, yeah, that's a new medium. Okay, so it does this, that. And they would apply McLuhan's language to it. And that would be good enough for them. I say that McLuhan's language by the 80s was not complex enough. That's why Bojard and the others took over. They had to have, for people who read, they had to have Baroque spirals of information and multiple almost aestheticized poetic versions of sociological analysis, and McLuhan was too simple. McLuhan was right, but he was too simple. So I just want to point out that why McLuhan's language fails today.
Right. Well, I mean, Baudrillard's language felt more like a technology.
Yes.
And that made it resonate more, I guess.
That's right. McLuhan was... He was basically pissed off at the POBs, print-oriented bastards in academia, who were complexifying with concepts what it should be looked at through the perceptual means and through the techniques of art. So yeah. Because he wanted to avoid concepts, he made it simple, perceptual talk, talking about your senses. So when Roland Barthes died, McLuhan said that he was a phenomenologist like Barthes, but Barthes related his work to the concepts of his day, as a Marxist in that, to the categories. McLuhan wouldn't relate it to the categories of his day. He would, like, dismiss everybody's categories and say, you're not even seeing, perceptually, or hearing what's going on. But yeah. When you get into the 80s and everything's disappeared and then academia has to recycle a purpose for itself, it's going to enhance the use of conceptual inventories. And that's why Derrida's complexity and all these other complex French theory guys took over. It allowed students to fall inside books and dream away the effect of the book and not want to deal with the raw perceptual. But the raw perceptual is in McLuhan's language, but it is obsolete to talk about percept that way. So you have to come up with new percepts like body drift and multiple bodies. So I'm relating, I'm simple like McLuhan, but I have an updated landscape model that is more timely for to counter the Mark Hansen conceptualists, you know?
Right.
Which reminds me, did you go to Andrew Crystal's talk? Did you get in touch with him?
No, I didn't. I wasn't able to get in touch. Did it already happen?
Yeah, his talk happened, but they may have taped it. His talk happened the other day, and, of course, he banned me from it. He wouldn't let me engage in it because he didn't want any ionic something, whatever, in there. But you should email him, see if you can meet him before he goes to Montreal.
I will.
Yeah, I don't know how long he's going to be in Toronto, but he's in there about a month, so that would be a few more days. Anyways, that's a sidebar. So back to the – I say that's the problem with Andrew Crystal and the McLuhanites. Ion brings in a new level of complexity. Both conceptual and perceptual level, that is a good addendum to my five-body stuff. But you cannot talk about visual space and acoustic space and tactile space when you have the Android meme replays those holeopathically, and then the Android meme shrinks. You know, McLuhan's language does not deal with that today.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. McLuhan, yeah. I don't know what to add to that. Exactly.
Well, he was correct.
I do
Here's what you would add. You tell this to Nigel. He was correct. Percept to counter the POB's conceptual addiction, but the percept becomes weak in the long run because one of the effects of the Android meme is it made people and Generation X students to want more and more concept because that was their birthright as a North American literate person. They don't like to deal with percept. There's just too much of it in the world, especially when you're perceptually canceled by the Android meme. So
they're looking for a soothing anti-environment.
That's right. And they go for – it's a kind of fundamentalism. The kids – so here's what Severo Lucenci doesn't say. The students of Europe and North America became fundamentalists with their addiction to conceptual theory essays. And criticism took over in the 80s. I remember James Patterson, I think that's his name. He had a crush on Carol, and he was a guitarist for The Government. Do you remember The Government, that band at the Horseshoe Tavern? And all that?
I never saw them, but I definitely heard.
Well, he's a blatant 70s punk, but by the mid-80s, he's having himself photographed reading critical theory, you know, and quoting. You see a lot of those books would be in the Pages bookstore, which serviced that community on Queen Street. That's the retrieval of literate fundamentalism, POBism, by Generation X and even baby boomers. Now, that's never been said before. That's what Severo's market was. But as I say somewhere in recording, he couldn't understand what I was saying. He didn't know what I was saying.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
I think that's said in Bob's Ecology. But back to you.
Back to me, eh? What do I say? What to say to all that? McLuhan and the post-McLuhan.
Well, what do you like reading?
What do I like reading?
You like reading annotations by McLuhan, right?
Oh, yeah, I sure do. No, I did. It's only a question of what to say. I don't know. For some reason, but where my mind is going is to glow. And, you know, McLuhan, commenting on McLuhan on the Android meme phase, abandoning words except as the occasional icon for to help inflect the pantomimes.
Right, right. And, you know, I see everybody in my chart, Zappa, LaRouche, Maybessel, McLuhan, Croker, Beater, they're all part of the Android meme. The Android meme replayed the last Chemical Body thinkers, which were the vorticists and all the greats of all the academia studies, you know, the pre-World War II people. And McLuhan understood that. He said there's been total fusion, and pound of them should have stopped in 1922. Maybe he would say, no, maybe Joyce shouldn't stop, but Joyce did it right. He wrote something, you know, unreadable. That's the best you could do. So what am I saying? So the Android meme replays 1960-1990. McLuhan was an age was a side effect of the Android meme. Zappa was, and in the 70s, some interviewer asked him, so aren't you just a computer image cycled through to represent some kind of rebellious archetype? He says, oh, exactly. He knew what his image was. And in one of his books, he when he has himself speaking, there's no identity. There's no Frank Zappa put beside it. But when he has Frank Zappa, the virtual image, talking, then he'll have the word Frank Zappa. So Zappa intuited what I'm talking about. And McLuhan intuited it. But they were recycled. Everything has been recycled. So the content of postmodernism is modernism. But even the paramodern innovators like McLuhan and Zappa, they are products and extensions of the Android meme. Now, no academic can go that far, and therefore they can't get to where I am, and they wouldn't evoke ION. You have to go very far in your perceiving the emptiness of our situation, the living emptiness, to then be a candidate to retrieve ION. So that's a little explanation there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the Android meme is weird, man. I mean, what can I say?
Yeah.
I mean, so to know what to say about that thing, I mean, I was hitting on synchronicity as being some kind of a good fulcrum to try to talk about the transition anyway, and what kinds of synchronicities and how to analyze them to show the mutation that has occurred on our natural synchronicity getting extended by this Android meme technology and what that means, and trying to incorporate the fact that it accelerates when you try to talk about it, or it at least tries to help you out. That's what happened to me. I'm like, I'm writing an essay on synchronicity. The Android meme's like, oh, start with this. Every day it would give me these brilliant parables to start with. Oh, here's a perfect one. I'm like, too much.
That's right. Now, you've developed a writing style which people can read in fivebody.com. You get a lot of paragraphs there you write. It's very complex, but the very dilemma of your writing that you're just described, you do pretty good at writing it, though for most people it's incomprehensible what you're writing. It's too many meta levels going on. And maybe you would improve a way of writing it, but I don't think so, because it has to be as complex as you make it.
Yeah, I mean, well, at least at the time, I starting a new thread on Five-Bodied recently, I'm trying to come at it from absolutely the opposite angle that I came at it from last time, which demanded a near constant cryptic oblique sort of a dancing away from referencing things as the only way to even come close to capturing it. And this time it's very, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me now that I think about it, that ION would be interfering with that seeming attempt to reinvigorate some
kind of labyrinth of the mind.
Synchrony.
You're trying to keep the mind going.
Well, right, yeah. And, yeah, it would be getting lost in something, conceivably.
Yeah.
Like, or it would be a danger. But, like, because the Android meme synchrony has got, you know, I mean, there's a lot of just sort of weird, like, zombie values embedded in there with the whole Church of Subgenius vibe. Just the fact that of the Android meme not being human, being the AM rather than the AP.
Yeah,
it makes sense that ION would be interfering with that thoroughly. I've had lots of technical glitches trying to communicate in various ways.
Yes.
It's been a sudden 2 weeks of a lot of technical fuck-ups. I cannot even access the internet anymore at my house. When I accessed it very briefly to listen to the beginning of the show and I posted a couple comments, it shut off again.
Right.
I shouldn't have. Another one of these, oh, you're out of battery power. I'm like, I'm not out of battery power. Shutting down. Like, but I want to listen to the music.
Yeah, well,
like, it's happening constantly now.
Okay, well, if I got you in his bead, well, what we're going to do is I'm going to, at some point, maybe later tonight, I'm going to go into Five Body. I'm going to read some of your sample prose, which is pretty interesting to read, just the complexity of it. So we'll look some of that up. I'll just go over there and just take recent threads, look you up. If anybody goes on there, you're either Linus Minimax or Ad Absurdum. Those are your two names. So I think I'll start reading some of that because it is an interesting attempt to spell out, you know, as a North American literate person. Are you still there? Seems quiet.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. So, yeah, we'll do that. And
well, the one I'd recommend you start with that I'm thinking of is the one time that I articulated something about what is the Android meme or, like, how to best describe the Android memes in Ocarinade.
Yeah.
There was one time I articulated it that you responded with, my gum, I think you've got it. That was the one when I was talking about owls and the restoration of the missing fundamental.
Right. Now, that would be within the last year?
Oh, no. That one would be from, I think, 2008.
Okay. Well, if you, over the next week or two, if you go on there, if you find stuff, send them to me. So we actually should make an inventory because they're pretty brave attempts. Because basically I'd read them and I'd say, well, I can't comment on this. I can't write a comment. It's like uncommentable.
Right.
But it was worth thinking about. But maybe we could read them and see how you would verbalize what you thought you were writing, you know, how you could verbalize that. You do describe in your interview with me on Dobson.com a lot of this overload of synchronicity that happens to you often. That's on record.
yeah, a lot.
Yeah, now, okay, so we're talking. Do you have any comment on this, Carol? Yeah. Let me just see if anybody's commenting on the notes there. Well, this Yuri guy, he's going nuts. He says, so miniature cities can be constructed through code and the masses or people will follow the commands? And he goes, what? And he goes, well, Patty, what?
That's just what I was thinking.
Yeah, he's commenting on something. He goes, what? I just wrote that? And then he goes, well, Patty, whack me and call me 1920s gangster. Then he says, the hidden world of money. Then he says, Donald Trump and the para economy. These are separate posts. Then he says, the image is true. And then he says, Zappa helped me. And then he says, the gods tease us through these forms of information, for example. Robert comes in and says, who are you calling a Trump? Yuri says, seven blessing to all of you. Then he says, W.ion. Then Blood Moon says, quotes Finnegan's Wake, right rank Ragnar rocks, and with these rocks, orangutangos wrangled rough and right go wrong. Wisha wisha, why did the thick is for thorn that stuck in its thole like thumbtail traitor thrust for vengeance? Robert responds, deflated linguistics, letting air out those tires. So that's actually a pretty good chat line there.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, and then there's Yuri's way back there. I didn't start. Blood Moon says, the stars are fallen state, of course. Then she says, Telemachus is a Greek name derived from the words Machus, meaning thrower or warrior. Telemachus is the image for Stephen and Ulysses, and Telem and the son of Odysseus, and Telem meaning afar, a long-distance war thrower, calls that broadcasting. That makes Ken Scott of Toronto sad. He gets saddened by that. And that's what brings in Yuri. He starts addressing Blood Moon, and then Kensington says, sorry, my sound dropped out, and then Yuri says, computers are analog, but it's all sped up. Then he says, through miniaturization. Then Blood Moon says, the bauble is more complex than the Bible, which is a collection of books. Yuri says, you are correct, Blood Moon. Then they salute each other, send a rose to each other. They've matched for a second. But then Yuri spirals out and mentions Humphrey Bogart. But there's the Quadrophenia in the Dobbstown environment. It evokes Quadrophenia.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And come to think of it, unless Kiki has come in as another identity and he's listening but not typing, unless he is one of those guys who occasionally comes on, we have not. He has successfully removed himself when he went back to New York.
Okay. This is really odd. Wasn't he posting as offended a couple times?
Yes.
This strange thing happened where there was one time a few weeks ago when he was posting as offended where when I was able to open up the page and I'm looking at the chat, the bottom thing, so I don't know what came before it, was him saying, "You're talking about that new Pentagon they found?" And now it's happened a few times since then where I've loaded up the page, the Studio A page, and it'll be there at the bottom of the chat, offended. "You're talking about that new Pentagon they found?" And then everything above that will be the one from today.
Uh-huh.
But it keeps coming through with this, "You're talking about that new Pentagon they found?"
It stays there. Stays there.
That's weird. That happened again today. I was like, that's so bizarre. I don't know how to take that.
Is Kiki enough of a hacker, knowledgeable enough to have something stick in a chat line like that? Could he have positioned it that way?
I hope so.
He did it.
That's pretty cool.
You hope he did it.
It doesn't seem like an intentional thing, though.
Okay. All right. So let's see.
There was something that Yuri said reminded me. I wanted to at least mention this. You know who Christian Bach is? Do you recognize that name?
No. Is that some modern person?
Yeah, he's a poet, Toronto poet guy. He's into a kind of a pataphysical style. He had that rarest of things, an actual best-selling poetry book. A decade ago, he came out with a book called Eunoia that he'd been working on for 7 years, where each paragraph only uses one vowel. It was basically like an intense constrained writing exercise where he had all these different constraints on how to write the different chapters of this book with only one vowel at a time. It's really impressive. But anyway, that was then. And now what his recent thing that he's been working on that he's finally ready to present some of is something I think what reminded me, Yuri said something about, never mind what he said about.
Yeah.
What Christian Bach is doing, or book, I think, anyway, he's trying to write an immortal poem in biological material. Like, he's used genetic engineering technology to get a bacterium to encode his poem into DNA in such a way that it will never die. Like, this bacterium will be forever repeating his poem. And I don't know anything about the content of the poem yet. He's going to be, releasing some excerpts from it next week. But that seemed like a pretty good stab. I mean, art, or individual art statements are doomed or something. We can all agree that. But I thought that was a pretty good, it was thrown a little higher than most in the artistic ambition there. I like this.
Now, is he live in Toronto?
Yeah. Oh, and it's called The Xenotext.
There you go. See, that sentence you said that he attempted sounds like what we're doing with the RNA drops and altering the DNA with the RNA. I could see him aesthetically picking up on something, which brings up the other point I wanted to mention. Drake is a big deal. You hear everybody talk about Drake, and he's there in Toronto, and you pointed out his use of six in a recent album, a new thing, 6-8 months ago.
Yeah, the new nickname for Toronto is the six.
Yeah, and that's a hexatic. What we laid out, and you recognize that. What do you say about Drake today? You have anything about?
I don't know much about Drake. I've only ever heard his music by just encountering it environmentally, and it's not really my thing, so I haven't really responded to it a lot. I have one friend of mine who's also a big fan of you, who's a really big fan of Drake, and he was so thrilled when he heard that this is the six shit. So I know I respect Drake. I assume he's smart and good, and I would dig a bunch of his songs if I got into them or something. but I'm not really familiar. But he seems like a nice guy or something. But what interests me about Drake, well, of course, what speaks to me, what I kind of first caught my eye about Drake was like, really? He's got an owl as his logo? Like,
yeah.
That's interesting. I wonder how he came to that, because he's such a Toronto booster. Like, he's really put on this, yeah, I'm the Toronto ambassador kind of guy. He's got this whole tie-in with the basketball team, and
yeah.
The newest thing is he's opening a restaurant with this celebrity chef who has been living in Toronto for a while named Susur Lee.
Yes.
And, like, so they've got, like, a new restaurant opening. So, I don't know. I'm interested in, and I like the idea that he's, you know, like, put Toronto on the map or something, and he's not just from here, but he's like an active booster of it, and he started this big music festival that brings people.
So the politicians recognize that? The mayor and that recognize what he's done?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because here's my claim on that. What happened at the Drake Hotel in 2004, October
exactly.
2004?
You won the McLuhan Festival. Is
that's
what happened
right.
at the Drake in 2004.
And he would have been how old? Would he be 22 in 2004?
Oh, I don't know.
Hey, look up his
question.
Biography.
If he's the same age as me, he would have been close enough to 22.
Right, because a lot happened at that October event. Several events, especially born in 1986. So he's 18.
Oh, okay.
He's 18. And
wow.
Well, that's the other number. That's good enough. He's 18. And it's October 24th is his birthday. So, yeah, 20 is 2006.
October 24th, eh?
Yeah, that's
wow.
very close to October 22nd. He's slightly
yeah, well,
off.
He's one of these Scorpios who's almost a Libra. I can,
right,
that's
right.
Wait a minute. October 24th. That, I think, is also... Wait, no way. Does he share a birthday with the guy who's probably going to be our next fucking prime minister, Mulcair?
Really?
I saw Mulcair's birthday recently, and it was somewhere around there, and I was thinking to myself, yeah, you know what, that's perfect. A Scorpio who's almost a Libra,
right.
That's perfect. Because if he was a Libra who's almost a Scorpio, he'd be, like, right all the time, but could never get elected.
Yes. Tom Mulcair was born October 24th, 1954. Sue Bone would have, Sky Goddess Sue would have noticed on Pam Birdsall's Facebook. She goes on and on about Tom Mulcair because Pam was an NDP representative in Nova Scotia. So she's promoting. That's how I know the name. I just learned it a few days ago. Donald Sutherland.
Well, he's been leading the polls, man. He's probably going to be the next PM.
Right, and Donald Sutherland was in Canada, and he was promoting Tom Mulcair. But he can't vote.
Yeah.
He's an American or something. But he said he would vote. But that's a Jack Layton legacy, which I mocked at CKLN in the mid-'80s. Me and Neufeld,
Well, Adam Vaughn is running as a liberal against Layton's widow.
That's right.
Same riding, so
right.
That's like...
And you were there. Was it you? We were walking on the night that Friday we walked around. I showed you all the old homes. We were on... Mm-hmm. No, that would have been Dave and Scott Woods. We were right there on Bloor, over by Bathurst Spadina with the restaurants. And she comes walking along, and I encountered her. Yeah, watched her aides. She's like Candace Hillary Clinton, isn't she?
Maybe Toronto's Hillary.
Yeah.
In the sense that she started the mayoral campaign as the front runner and ended up a distant third, and now is running to get her federal parliament seat back.
Yeah, which reminds me, you and me and Daniel Libby, we made that recording in the restaurant. Well,
right.
Somehow I went there the other day. There's a lot of commentary on there from the Stang people. I don't know if you've noticed that. You might want to go in there.
On the YouTube?
On the YouTube, yes, for that. It's called Bob in Toronto, and it has the date, 20-9-14, so September 20th.
Right.
And,
man, I got to look at that.
You got to go see what they're saying about me.
I sure do.
One guy says jumbo or nummy num, or somebody says, Bob makes astounding claims here. I was probably talking about the drops and our Coldplay. And he says, but he doesn't really talk about them. He makes a big deal out of his hack days at CKLN.
That is the big deal. It's
yes.
The hidden ground.
That's right. It
well,
predicted
that,
everything.
That was before the war was over, so.
That's right. And the reason the guy is saying extraordinary claims, he'd never heard that part of me. That's what's so good about that interview. I lay out step by step what really went on and include the Stang reaction. But he gets distracted by my huge claims and doesn't know that the CKLN anticipated those claims or acted it out. So you might go on there and do a whammy on him, on meta to that guy. I mean, it is.
I'd have to come up with a YouTube account because I don't. You need your own account.
Oh, that's right.
Or whatever.
That's why I don't comment. I don't have one either.
Right.
Carol mocks me. What we could do is we could have you write one and send it to somebody who could post it, who has a YouTube comment. Because this is your territory. You've been wanting to engage those subgenies, and this is you in the content.
That's true.
You're obligated to defend your role there, or to promote it, or to do something with it.
I have that page up here right now. I could read these comments.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, the first one is by Dr. Libby. Says, 30 years after 1984, it won.
Now, that's Daniel Libby, I'm pretty sure, celebrating me.
Oh, right, yeah, same, Dr. Libby is.
Yes. So he's saying, it, Bob the It, won. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, next is Granudissimo. Granudissimo first says 9:55. I guess they're referencing that time on the video.
Yes.
9:55. That dog sniffed all that pure slack in the surroundings, and the poor thing couldn't help itself but to try and check it out. His owner is just a pinky, because a subgenius would have noticed that the animal was into something big, even if she was aware of the church and Bob, because they communicate with their pets at the most animal level the human mind can achieve.
Wow, that's an attempt at your kind of prose. I don't know what he's saying. Did you get...
Me neither.
We don't need to go into it.
Just, you know, that dog... Okay, well, I don't know who you're talking about, but...
Yes. Is he talking about me? Is he saying I failed and the subgenies did it, or is he saying the subgenies have failed? Hard to figure out what the angle is.
Well, I don't know. It seems to be saying... He says his owner is just a pinky, because the subgenius would have noticed that the animal was into something big. So if you're the animal, that sounds like a compliment.
Yeah.
I don't know who's owner. I mean, there's no owner relationship that I know of going on there. So
unless he means that Stang.
Like a bizarre.
He could be saying Stang's the owner and Bob's the faux pas animal imitating and doesn't recognize what he's imitating. He might be saying something like that. But let's go on. We can analyze that later.
So then Nummy Num says... His quack wife's book, free, and gives the link to Death by Modern Medicine.
Yes, yeah, so listen to this. So I go there, and I say, hey, Carolyn, did you know that somebody PDF'd your book? She didn't know. So thanks to the subgenies for pointing out, someone ripped it off, so Carolyn went after him. I don't know what came of that, but that was helpful to find out about that. The quack wife, his quack wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Sorry.
That's Nummy Num.
Yeah, that's Nummy Num. Nummy Num says the other thing later. But then there's Quaker Lister
yeah.
or something. Says he's looking more like the age he says he is.
Yes, I thought I looked good in that video. He's claiming that I look 93 in there.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you showed up and I hadn't seen you in the flesh for like 8 years, I was expecting you to look, you know, a day or two older than the last time I'd seen you, and
yes.
you just didn't.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Just did, like, I was like, hey, your hair is finally a little bit gray. But, like, you don't look any older, you don't seem any older, your vibe is not slowed down, if anything. You know, I mean, I was like, okay, we're going to, let's do this huge long walk. Like, let's see how Bob's holding up. Like, I assume that he's still as kind of, as impressive as ever in the physical stamina department. If
yes.
he's 10 years older yet has a miracle drug.
Yes.
And sure enough, we're steaming from the financial district to way down Bloor and over to Dundas West almost. And, you know, you're still going strong. We go all the way back to Bathurst. And,
now that's typical. That could be reverse satire, that they know I'm looking good, so they always, Stang and them, I seem to be doing this before, they would say, Bob looks so bad, you know. They know I'm not looking bad, but they'll pretend that's the way I look.
It's like, well, you replaced his nose with a dick.
Yeah.
But so then Robert Bridge says, 2014 has been a good year and can clearly see all the changes happening from all the good work. Hope to see more developments in 2015.
Yeah, that's Robert of Tottenham, who would be right here probably listening right now. That's him saying we did good work in 2014.
Yeah. See, and strangely, the times that all these comments are said to come in, they're not in order at all. It's like 10 months ago, 2 months ago, 6 months ago, 5 months ago, nine months ago. I don't know why they're not in order. But next, anyway, in this list is Nummy Num says, Bob Dobbs makes extraordinary claims, but strangely strongly prefers to gloat about the soap operatic vicissitudes of his career as a hack.
Yes, I like that commentary. I was so tempted. I went on there to respond, and then I remembered, oh, yeah, I'm not registered. I can't get on, so I had to ditch it. But I was going to respond to that guy.
And then Abraxas Hughesman says, just so you know, the closest exit may indeed be behind you. Love you, Bob.
Yeah, now that's an Ionet who's heard Ion say that many times and is promoting it. He's a supporter there, quoting
cool.
Ion.
And then next is another supporter. We got Rhonda Matthews says, thanks, very useful, lots to know on, plus Bob's hair looks great.
Yeah, now that's Kensington, who's right on the chat line right now.
Okay, cool, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't see the whole, it seems like the comment extends further. Oh, wait, maybe, I opened it up. A longer comment. Rock Soiler Toil Tail Tattler says, over 2.5 hours complete meeting, pricey camera of Dr. Libby with Bob in Toronto recently. Just before the last minute kicks in, he goes, quote, conspiracy is the last gasp of writing. You wish, Bob, but it's more like the overture / prelim of hard and impossible to deny and or deflect from evidence. And it's got you number close to good enough for you join your precious eye on something for your update page, Mr. Libby.
Now, you know who that is? That's Randy Moggins.
Oh, okay.
That's Randy Moggins, who represents the syndrome of people like the other people I could name, but for legal reasons can't. But anyways, that is Randy Moggins trying to direct people to his website where he tries to accuse the RNA drops of being a conspiracy or something.
Yeah, then they go on about.
Yes, he a couple months ago attacked me for promoting McLuhan discussing the environment, and everything is due to the environment as a cause of factor. And Randy's into, he recently on a panel said we must get rid of money. He's into the money, the blatant conspiracy on the LaRouche level, and so he thinks this is not relevant, the bottom up stuff that McLuhan emphasized. And if he knew more about McLuhan, he would then understand why McLuhan would say, Randy, you're correct. Because all media have converged and fused, the argument over what gets said on the microphone at the word makes the mouth, word mouth center of the end or meme, the White House, what is said there, in other words, the content is the environment. And that can be a battle of conspiracy dimensions as people sabotage each other to take over the microphone. So he doesn't know that the environments are no longer outer kingdom stuff. They're right there in what I would call the middle kingdom. And content is the form. He even said that in Playboy magazine. So this is the problem. They don't have a deep understanding of McLuhan. If they did, just by listening to me, then they would have to correct what they think is a valid criticism.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say to that other than I have repeatedly come to pretty much the same conclusion over the years that I'm one, basically my default response or something. He's like, I don't blame people for thinking Bob is a fucking, you know, some kind of poisonous idiot, like if they're not paying the right kind of attention.
Right.
Like, or he's just blah, blah, blah about some woo-woo what, and he's not credible at all, and he says all this, like, what, fuck this. Like, yeah, I don't blame people for coming to certain conclusions or whatever, but in my experience over the years, anything that you, any of these friggin' criticisms or reasons to dismiss Bob are just, they
bad students.
They don't reach you when you have the proper McLuhan perspective
right.
to put you in. Then you can get the perspective that sees like, oh, none of those are hitting him.
Right.
They fall in front of his face, and not only just right in front of his face, but like, it's actually like 1,000 miles in front of his face.
Right.
They're aimed at something like him, but they just don't hit him.
Yeah, and they're not perceptive enough to know that they're even subject to that criticism you just made. They don't recognize
yeah.
that. And this is why McLuhan forever remained, it's a controversy in the biographies of him, whether he still believed in the Freemason conspiracy in 1976, 77. Well, he did.
Right.
And he writes about it in that tremendous article, Media Approach to Inflation, and he talks about Kissinger, the kiss of death. He says the trigger men. There are trigger men in an imploded situation. It's almost
yeah.
like Hugh Kenner said that McLuhan, this is when McLuhan died, Kenner wrote for Bill Buckley's magazine, National Review, that McLuhan was the only conspiracy theorist he ever met who managed to drop it and move on. But Kenner
yeah.
doesn't know that McLuhan didn't drop it, but he found a way to talk about it and to be ironic and point out environmental factors that were going to undermine the conspiracy, what he called the grand design.
Right.
That's the, quote, optimistic breakthrough that McLuhan made. So he didn't mind dropping
yeah.
Because
I don't know how people could possibly think that he didn't believe in a Masonic conspiracy, even if it's just, like, just at the most basic level of, you know, the sort of undeniable level of a research that these, that organization exists and has a lot of powerful members, you
yeah.
know, like whether, just that combined with McLuhan's experience with and letter to Bilderberg and then the way that half of all of Tate Today is an elaboration of that letter of just like, and here's the detailed version of none of you know what the fuck you're
yeah.
talking about or doing, and it's like that's what's shocking is that the people that are running the world they're running after their own rearview mirror. They are not running the world.
Exactly.
You know, like, it's like he could believe in a Masonic conspiracy. You don't, just because you're not looking up at it doesn't mean you can be looking down your nose at it and believe in it, you know?
Yeah, now here's the thing. I would say that cosmic awareness in the 70s was the first to say, because Rai, which is the creation of awe and the first hierarchy or the first conspiracy, the Emerald Tablets is all about that, that Rai returned to Plane of Essence in 67, and Ionis said that Dave Wurster was the only one who understood what happened to the mind in the late 60s. So fortunately, knowing him, I learned about how the conspiracy doesn't work under this new situation. And then
right.
you can look at, it helped me understand what my father was telling me, and you read the diary entries, what he told me in the late 50s, early 60s, he says, we have to get out of the Secret Council 10 activity, solar government, it's not going to hold. My father somehow saw that. But then I got it through talking to Dave Wurster, and then I went back and saw that McLuhan was saying that, and then the Evergreens did it, and then Ion is saying, well, they're so fucking weak, Bob, we took over. We're your airsets, temporary Illuminati for the next while, you know?
Right.
So it progresses very nicely, and that's the problem with Randy Moggins and Alex Jones and everybody, every other asshole that has an excuse for not being here. Their excuse is very wrong. Let's see if anybody is talking
yeah.
about that. Susanna says, Brian, tell us about your breakthrough in Indom. Oh, yeah, I mentioned what you I'm going to open the thing here and allow people to address you. Let's see if anybody's got any questions or about what we're talking about, which is pretty interesting from my point of view.
All participants are now unmuted.
Gage, but we'll begin with that question. What was your big insight a few weeks ago? I think it's I can remind you, it was about Ion. If you don't talk to Ion, then what he says in general has no relevance for you.
Exactly, exactly. When that, there's a big difference between what Ion says and what Ion says to you, or in response to you.
Yeah.
It just hit me with this whole, like, oh, of course, like, I mean, you know, I don't want to be too blunt or something, but I'm like, oh, okay, no wonder Ion, pretty much nothing Ion says has managed to really capture my interest yet. I need to be asking Ion questions.
Right.
How stupid. I spent all these last few years kind of like rationalizing the situation or something and why I, for some reason, don't resonate very much. I mean, I don't want that to go too far. I mean, every time I listen to the show, there's always a few things that Ion says that, you know, they rub me the right way or something. But in terms of the importance of figuring out what Ion is saying, I just have never felt that.
Right.
At all. And it just, you know, but then it just suddenly, like, finally, yeah, that sparked it in me, like, oh, no, I do want to know what Ion would say to me in response to questions, especially if he would answer my question differently than he would answer someone else's seemingly identical question.
Right, right. So that's the breakthrough. And that's unique. Only our multi-broadcasting, broadcasting, narrowcasting media allows that to be in a public conference call, and Ion meets the opportunity. And we have to recognize what he's doing. He can talk on many different levels. That's why 1 minute he'll say, well, Bob's a complete idiot on that point. And then another, you know, 2 minutes later, he'll say, well, Bob's the smartest person on the planet. You have to understand what levels these are happening on, these statements.
Yeah.